Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Lisa, from All of Our Affairs Group in Pipersville.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Well, well, well. Hey, everybody. How you doing? My name is Lisa, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
And my home group is the In All Our Affairs 10, 11, 12 step meeting in Pipersville, and that's at the Little Red Schoolhouse, right at Irish Meeting House Road and Elephant Road. And that's on every Tuesday night at 7:30. Great place. Stop by. It's not far from here, you know. And my sponsor is Susan and from Doylestown. I've had a couple different sponsors in the past, and I have a couple women that I, you know, women and men that I call on just for spiritual direction or whatever. So I was asked to come here tonight by Jack to speak, and I wanted to thank him very much for asking me to walk through these fears here. I've never stood at a podium and spoken or for a whole hour before, so I was a little bit apprehensive about doing it, but I've learned in my sobriety that, you know, when you're afraid of something, just, you know, push through it, push through the fears, and it's not about you, it's about the other person. And so I'm here tonight to, you know, hopefully bring some inspiration and share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you, and hopes that somebody might be able to get a little something out of it. my sobriety date is March 19th, 2007. And that in itself to me is a miracle. And the only reason why I stand here before you is because men and women like you came before me and, you know, held the door open for me and greeted me and said hello like you did. This was one of the meetings I came to pretty regularly in my early sobriety. I forgot it was my anniversary last week. My aunt had asked me to, she's in the program, and she had asked me to go to New York with her. She was speaking at a conference there. So I went, and it was just amazing. It was amazing to see all the people in the fellowship and how this works all throughout, you know, the country. And I realized after that meeting there that some of the people that I've met that have the strongest sobriety and the longest sobriety and are the happiest in AA, are Alcoholics Anonymous, are all involved in service in one way or another, you know, and they continue to be involved in service because without them, you know, we wouldn't have what we have right now. And there were a couple speakers that were, you know, they were just so inspiring to me. There was, you know, when I wasn't sure if I could handle a whole hour, you know, and then somebody else was saying to me, well, sometimes, you know, you have a hard time getting out of the 70s at 20 after, and I'm like, yeah, I think you're right, you know, so maybe I can start, maybe I can finish this time. But when I was there in New York, one of the speakers was talking about, you know, like, oh, do you know what it means when somebody gets up there, they start their story, they're into it for like 20 minutes or so, and they're still in grammar school, and then they take their watch off, and they put it on the podium, and, you know, he's like, you know what that means? And we're like, yeah, no, I don't know what it means. He's like, it means nothing, you know, it means nothing at all. They just take their watch off, and they're just going to do what they want anyway. So this guy started speaking, and there he was. He's 20 minutes into it, and he's talking about grammar school. And another guy in the crowd, you know, just got up, and he walked out, and he was looking at him, and he was a little bit aggravated. And so when the guy, about an hour or so into his talking, guy came back in the room, and he sat down, and he's like, you know, he's got his eye on him. He saw him sitting there the whole time, and then after the meeting, you know, everybody, he's looking at the guy, they line up and they're talking to the speaker and they, you know, and he said, hey, I couldn't help but notice that you, as soon as I started talking, you know, you left pretty early on. And he's like, yeah, and he's like, you know, and then you came back, you know, like after you came back, you know, it was almost at the end, and he said, you know, where did you go? Where did you go? And the guy said, well, I went to go get a haircut. And he's like, you went to get a haircut? Why didn't you get a haircut, you know, before the meeting started? And he just looked at him, and he's like, because I didn't need a haircut before the meeting started, you know? So that was, like, my fear that I was going to be up here, and I'm going to be, like, talking about, you know, the 70s the whole time. So I won't. I'm going to start in the 60s. So, anyway, I just thought that was funny when you know, when I heard that when I was there. It was just one of those things that made my heart, you know, made my heart just sing. And I just heard a lot of, you know, laughter that whole weekend that I was there. I was born in Northeast Philly, raised 5 brothers, sisters, and... it was an alcoholic household, but, you know, I hate to call individuals in my family alcoholics because they don't necessarily consider themselves ones. So that's for all of us to decide on our own, you know, if we're alcoholic or not. That's what I was told. Like, you know, you don't put point. We have to decide for ourselves when we walk in here and understand that we're alcoholic. And I was going to let my dad hear this tape and... Then I thought, I can't let him hear that, you know, because my aunt called him one, and I don't want, so I want to kind of be careful of that. But, you know, I learned, I didn't have an easy time when I got sober in here. I did not have an easy time admitting I was powerless. My story basically is one of a lot of denial. So in my house when I grew up, it was one of these things where, I was just always afraid. I was always feared up. I was afraid in school. I was afraid if people would call my name. I didn't want people to talk to me. I don't know why I was like that. I just was. You know, way before I was an alcoholic or I thought I was when I was a kid, I was just restless, irritable, discontent. You know, it started a long time ago. And... I never knew what was going to happen at home. You know, one day everything was fine and dandy and my dad came in and we were allowed to laugh and joke. And the next day, all hell broke loose. But I could usually tell by, you know, the footsteps, the way the door opened, the way the car went around the corner, the way somebody was breathing, you know, what the day or what the night was going to be like. And that... I was always afraid, you know, that always feared me up. So, as I went through school, like I said, you know, I was always paranoid and scared and all that stuff. I was probably about 13 or 14 years old when I first picked up my first drink. My parents drank a lot at home. There was a lot of fighting going on, and I always just knew I would drink. You know, it was not a big deal. It was just, you know, a rite of passage. And when I started drinking, and I picked up when, you know, with my friends, I remember just thinking that, not that I've arrived, but I was able to just put my head up and talk to people, and I wasn't as scared and insecure and... I didn't care about a lot of things, you know. I did a lot of things that I wouldn't have done had I not had that alcohol in me. But from the time I started drinking and, you know, I would really basically put anything in my body that would make me feel different than how I felt and think different than how I thought, because I was really always worried about what people thought and what, you know, what they thought of me, because that's the way I was raised, you know. I feared God. And you better worry about what other people think. And it doesn't matter what you think, and it really doesn't matter. You know, children are to be seen, not heard, that type of thing. So when I drank and when, you know, we used to go to these keg parties behind Washington High School and hang out down at the railroad tracks. And I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait every Friday to, you know, go back there and hang out with everybody. And, you know, before that, we would even just go back at the abandoned buildings in Byberry and drink and go through the, you know, the buildings. Like, I wouldn't do that if I wasn't, you know, a little buzzed. But, you know, I met these people and I thought that they were my friends, and I was able to, you know, whatever. It was the 70s, so everybody was just doing their, you know, doing their thing. And like I said before, you know, if anybody asked me to try something, I tried it. Sometimes I tried it more than once. I always just wanted to know what everything did for me. But I would always go back, you know, to the alcohol, to the Mad Dog 2020, to Boone's Farm, you know, that type of thing. And I remember thinking that I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because I didn't like the taste of beer. And the alcoholics that I knew drank beer, and they drank whiskey straight, and they drank scotch, and I wasn't really, I tried everything, but I didn't like the taste of those things. So I thought that only alcoholics, you know, like that. By the time I was, 10th grade summer, 15, 16 years old, hanging out with my friends and thinking was whatever, I wound up getting pregnant, and I went home, and it was sort of like, you know, you made your bed, you lie in it. So my mom and dad wanted me to give my daughter up for adoption, and I didn't want to do that. You know, back then I already knew that in my head, you know, I don't know, I just didn't want to do it. I couldn't do it. So I wound up, they married me off a month later after my 16th birthday, and I moved to Germany. And that's where I learned to drive while I was drinking, you know, no speed limit on the Autobahn. And pretty much, you know, I had a ration card, and I would ration my alcohol. Sometimes I would sell it to the Germans. But, you know, I played cards, and I partied a lot there. I ironed fatigues for money. And, you know, I just remember waking up on the floor quite a few times. I thought, you know, just doing shots. Now I'm advancing to, you know, Bacardi 151 and playing cards and stuff. But I never really thought I had a drinking problem. You know, I always just tried to figure out how to get that perfect combination so I wasn't dead on the floor, and, you know, but it always made me feel good. So as time went on, I wound up coming home. You know, I got in a lot of trouble over there for some things, and so did my ex. And he got sent away to Mannheim prison over in Germany, and I came home a year later and wanted to go down to the corner and hang out with all my friends. And they, you know, most of them that I hung out with before weren't allowed to, you know, hang out with me. But now I'm already, I got the buzz. I got the bug, and I want to party, and I want to drink, and that's what my life revolved around. Really, there was nothing else. That was a defining moment when I had my daughter. It's like, okay, well, you know, now I have to work, and I have to make money, and I have to support her. And as long as I do those things, then, you know, that's all that matters. So my friends were at the corner. I remember them driving by in a candy apple red Mustang, but they were going to senior week for high school, and because they had just graduated school. And I remember having like this resentment towards the entire Jersey Shore, you know. But I found this group of girls, these women that were having this wine and cheese party, that I'm still friends with a lot of them today. And they're a big part of my story, they were a big part of my drinking. And we became friends, probably we were like 17 years old. But we all drank alike. We drank very similar. So when I got to go out, and I didn't have my daughter 3 days a week, I had a roommate, and, you know, we would go to all-you-can-drink nights. And I bartended at Cherry's. I always had two or three jobs. There was a place called Cherry's in Andalusia. You have to be pretty old to remember it. But, you know, under 21, and we would do, you know, all kinds of other things while we're working. But, you know, I didn't realize that until I got sober and I looked back on my life that everything I did was revolved around alcohol, no matter what it was. And so I'm working at the bar, I have my daughter, I go out, and everything I do is surrounded with alcohol. And, you know, I met this guy at 19 years old, and he was in a band, and we hooked up, and we wound up living together for 16 years. Full-blown alcoholic. What I did was I completely recreated this home life that I had that I so wasn't ever going to, like, I just wanted to get out of the house. When I moved away, I had never been even away for a weekend, and I didn't want to come home. I just wanted to stay there, you know. I just wanted to do what I was doing. But, you know, I did come home and I just lost my train of thought. But, so this guy that I met, had I not been in the frame of mind I was in, you know, looking back, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I know that I would have never been there. You know, we talk about hostages, being hostages, taking hostages. But as long as I could look at people my whole life and they drank as much as me or more than me, then I didn't think that I was that bad. But as I progressed, they progressed, and, you know, things got worse. There were a lot of parties. There were a lot of keg parties. You know, used to go through a couple Beermeisters a week because the band played a few days a week, and there was a lot of fighting, and there wasn't a lot of being a good mom. You know, I tried my best, but by the time I was like 24, again, my sobriety date's March 19th, 2007, and that was the first time I came in the program and really it was the first time I haven't gone out since then, but I didn't want to admit before then, you know, I ever had that much of a problem. But looking back, like I said, when you shine that flashlight through your life, like I went out. I used to go to the Croydon VFW. We'd go anywhere. My boyfriend's band was playing. There was a guy that got killed, DUI, drunk and driving on his motorcycle. And I would go over and get my booze and keep it in the car and fill up my drink and then go back in the bar and come back out and fill it up. And I wound up getting this one night I got into a fight with him, and I was leaving the VFW, and you know, I would always drive fast. I thought I could drink and drive. I thought I drove faster or better when I drove. I when I was drunk, I really didn't care. You know, it never dawned on me. I mean, we all drank and drove, and if you got pulled over and, you know, we used to go to Jersey. It was only 18 to drink. And the reason why I talk about all this right now is just there was, you know, there's three parts to my story. There was this, what it was like, you know, just nonstop drinking. And I never went to school, college. I did go back and get my GED, but, you know, I remember leaving that VFW, and I was leaning on the door, and I couldn't get out, and the guy opened the door, and I got in my car, and I just floored it, and I woke up in the hospital the next day, and I went through the hedges and the swing set and into the house, and apparently I'd opened the door, and like where my scar is, I knocked all my teeth out with the steering wheel, and when I made amends, when I got sober, you know, I had to go to my father and tell him when he and my brother went to where they impounded my car, you know, with shotguns, and they're like, look, we're just looking for my daughter's teeth. You know, we got to put them back in her face. And I never thought that I hurt anyone or harmed anyone with my drinking, but, you know, because I lived alone and I didn't ask anybody for anything, you know, no one paid my bills. But I stole people's peace of mind. I stole their serenity, you know. I used to worry my daughter sometimes when I went out. I remember I came home. I was laying on the couch one day. I was always hungover. I don't know how people get hungover. But I had this apartment in Ben Salem, probably till I was about 23, 24, before I bought my house in Levittown. And, you know, she brought over I wanted her to go to church. I wanted her to believe in God. And during the holidays, I would go over to Our Lady of Calvary where I grew up. But I would let her to go to different denominations, you know, with people. And one day she came in, I'm hung out over on the couch, and she just said, Mom, I invited the pastor and his wife home. And I'm like, what for? And she's like, well, I want them to save you, you know, but you can't smoke and you can't drink and you can't curse. And, you know, I was probably only about 20, maybe 22, 23 at the time. And so, you know, I let this little girl have these people come in and save me, you know. But that's how much she was worried about me all the time. That's how much she, you know, and I didn't realize that. But, you know, instead of letting her continue with dance, I needed that money to drink. And instead of letting her continue with some of the sports she was in, I needed that money to drink. And as the years went by, I remember I was about 30 at the time, and I started seeing this therapist. I was working. I always had a couple jobs. One was always bartending to so I could drink, and then I always had another job so I could have insurance. And then at this point, I was working over in Princeton at a radio station, and I would go after all the clubs on Delaware Avenue, you know, and up and down. We all drank, you know, we all drank the same way. It was a little bit out of control. But I remember seeing this therapist, and she tried to talk me into for 6 months stopping drinking, and I never knew why. I didn't understand why she was trying to do that. I was like, aren't you listening to me? I tell you how screwed up he is and what he's doing, and why are you telling me I have to quit drinking? So eventually I did. After about 6 months, I listened to her. She said, so that you can see your life more clearly, you know, and you can see what you're doing to yourself. So I quit. And it took me, I would go back to her every week. And I remember then I got obsessed with working out, and because I switched whatever I was doing. But after about a few months of doing that, I realized I thought, well, I proved to everybody I'm not an alcoholic. I never went to AA. I never called myself an alcoholic. I just quit to be self-righteous, really, to show somebody else. But I always thought about having it. And I remember one day when it snowed, and I wanted to take, I had a snowmobile. We all had snowmobiles, and we were taking them out. And I remember picking up a white Russian because I would make my own Kahlua. And I thought, I remember the day standing there that I picked it up, and I drank it, and I never put it down again, for 16 more years. But my drinking progressed. That relationship ended, and then I met my husband, and I just thought, well, now I have arrived, you know. He lived in Doylestown, and he had money, and talked me into quitting my job, and I could just stay home. And the first thing I did, I remember he bought me 2 bottles of wine on our first date, and I thought, oh my God, like, I love this dude, you know, this is like awesome. This is great. From that moment on, when I moved into him, of course, immediately I go from one to the next and overlap it, and we moved in together, and then we got married. I drank every night, and then I drank every day, and I drank with my coffee, and this relationship that started out really good for a very long time, eventually. We both started getting into other things, and we were pointing the finger at each other, and he would say, I'd say, you'd stop buying that stuff. And he'd say, I don't tell you about your drinking. Don't tell me about doing this. And I'm like, well, if I'm drinking, I have to do that. And if I do that, then I have to drink. So, we started living in different areas of the house. And if I was drinking and doing the other stuff, then I needed something to help me go to sleep. And then I needed something to wake up. And then, as days and years and months rolled on, I started losing me more and more and more, Now my daughter's grown, and she started having children, and she wanted them, she didn't want them to come over and see me anymore, because they would come over and they'd be like, Gigi, how come you always have wine in your coffee cup? How come you always drinking? You always drinking. And I didn't trust myself after a while either. I didn't trust what I was capable of doing, where the drink was going to take me, what I was going to say or do. I was always like life of the party girl. And I had a lot of so-called thought they were friends. My ex used to say, they're not your friend. They just like to watch the monkey dance. The monkey dances when she goes around. And, I didn't know what that meant for a while, but, when I drank, I got this energy. I got this crazy, crazy energy. I'd be like really tired and I don't want to go out, and I'd be like, come on, just have one. And once I had one or two, something changed inside of me, Once I put, if you told me I could only have one drink, I didn't want to drink because it didn't make any sense to me. And if you told me I could have two, I didn't want that either, because then I would get a headache if I couldn't have three. So I just, I just always wanted more and more and more. And eventually I just couldn't ever get enough. I mean, he would be like, you know, everybody loves Lola when Lola comes out to play, because Lola liked to party and play, you know. And he's like, but nobody sees Lucifer when Lucifer comes home. And you know, I didn't respect the fact that he worked for a while. Then he quit his job and he stayed home on the couch for years. And, you know, towards the end, but that's because of what this addiction did to him, or this did to him as well. And so it destroyed what I thought that I had, and I really wanted him to rescue me, and I was trying to help him. But, you know, I finally, you know, I got to the point where, you know, it doesn't matter, like, the defining characteristics of alcoholism, how many trees I wrap my car around, how many DUIs I got, you know. It was what it did to me, or each one of us, that, like, when you get to that point that, you know, as they talk about in the big book, where you the incomprehensible demoralization, where you know you can't live with it and you can't live without it anymore. And I didn't know what was happening to me, you know. I slowly but surely just started to lose me and lose myself and lose the woman that I was, the person that I was. I was whoever you wanted me to be. I never really had, like, a true identity of who I was. I tried to fit in with everybody because I could be a chameleon, you know, no matter where I went. And I remember laying there, you know, in my basement, because eventually I would never go up to bed anymore. I would just go to sleep in the basement, and then he'd be like, oh, well, you're drinking. How many times you come up and go to the bathroom? So I would just start to go outside, you know. I wouldn't go upstairs anymore, so he didn't, you know, he couldn't control what I was doing. And you know, I think he knew how much, what would happen when I would never admit I had a drinking problem. And I would go to the different liquor stores and buy a case of wine, the big bottles, every 3 days, because I would drink two bottles a day. I'd start in the morning. By mid-afternoon, I'd have one done, then I'd start. But I would try to do all the different things to control it. You know, I would try to put ice in it. I would try to put club soda in my wine. I would try to switch drinks. I would try to drink vodka. You know, I went through a vodka kick. I went through a Tanqueray kick. But he would know if I ran out that I would do anything to go get it, you know, and I would leave no matter what time of night or day, usually to go hang out with somebody no matter where I had to go to get what I needed to get. So he'd always have a stash for me hidden places. And I used to think that was so cool and loving, you know. I really did. But I do remember this one day towards the end of when I quit drinking. It was like a year. I used to say I was able to quit drinking. I was able to quit working just because he wanted me to stay home. But really, here's what happened. So it was St. Patty's Day, and it was about 10 years before I quit drinking, you know. So the car accidents were in my 20s, in my 30s. I remember coming home from work one night. I was at the radio station, and then I had a long beard contest in Princeton where you walk around on St. Patty's Day and everybody grew the beard for the month. And then we walked around, you know, with the beer from pub to pub. And then I left there because it was over at whatever time in the afternoon. And that wasn't good enough for me. So I, you know, went to Levittown, drank with a bunch of friends there. And then they were doing something. So I left. I went to the Northeast Philly, you know, drank there till 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I was driving home. And I remember going up 611 and thinking, oh, I think there's a, you know, the one eye thing. You know, there was a checkpoint, so I decided to go up Street Road and down, you know, Witch Hunt County and Warwick. And I remember the cop pulled me over, but so many nights I drank and drove thousands. And I remember they pulled me over, and I'm just thinking, like, I'm not going to talk because I've seen this cop shows, and if I talk, he's going to know I'm drunk. But I couldn't open my door. And he's like, calm down, it's all right, you know, just settle down, you'll get the door. And I'm like, oh, fine, I get the door open. And I get out, and, like, you know, I got a suit on and a white shirt, and it's all open. I've got green shamrocks painted all over my boobs and, you know, doing, like, talk about that incomprehensible demoralization. And, you know, I had to do the field sobriety test right there on York Road. And you do know that's just for their entertainment. It's not, you know, admissible in court or anything. But I was like three times the legal limit or whatever. It was, I forget what it was. It was pretty high. And I got a DUI. I got taken to the hospital. They drew blood. I wouldn't talk in the car or anything. I don't think I did. I don't remember. I know I didn't want to talk. But he did drive me home eventually, you know, to my house. And then you got to wake up the next day. How's everything? Well, got to go get my car. Where's your car? I was impounded for what, you know? And so what I decided to do was at that point I was just going to make everybody else drive, you know, because now I got a DUI and I can't drive. And, you know, and then I would hide the bottles in my trunk and I would, it was a lot of work. It was just a lot of work to hide it and to drink and to figure out what time I could start, what time I was going to end so I didn't have to leave. So I had my stash and, you know, my supply. And slowly but surely, like I was saying earlier, like I just started to lose me. I started to lose myself. I started to lose the person that I was, you know. I couldn't talk to him anymore upstairs. He was out of his mind. Hey, don't talk to me. I'm watching TV. It's like you're watching the Three Stooges for the 47th time. You know, put it on hold. It was like insane, you know. You go upstairs and there's like sheets over all my windows because, you know, paranoid. Somebody's looking in on the second floor up high, you know, third floor. Nobody's looking at anything. But, the mailbox was stuffed and there were just, you know, notices and nothing was taken care of. And then I'm not picking up after you and you can live in that area and I'm going to live in this area. And, you know, my daughter just started saying to my friends, like, what's wrong with my mom? Like, what's wrong with my mom? You know, like, she was just so disgusted with me, I could tell all the time. And physically, I wasn't feeling good, you know. I wasn't good at all. I was sick constantly. My legs hurt so bad. Every time I laid down, I had neuropathy, and I didn't know it. And I was just, like, kick my legs when I'm laying on the couch and roll around, and they... You know, I didn't know I was anemic. And if you asked me what year it was, and it was 2007, I wouldn't have remembered. You know, I'm like, I don't know, 2005? Is it January? Is it? I didn't know what time of the night it was. I didn't know what time of the day it was. My basement was really dark. But, you know, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter where, you know, where we come from. Like, let me just finish where I was there. But, you know, I got to that point where I didn't know how this happened to me, you know. I still couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. What I thought was if I stopped all the other stuff I was doing, then maybe I could just drink normal, you know. And but I knew I drank too much, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic because, you know, alcoholics drink beer and they drink scotch and I didn't like those. I was just, you know, a major wino. I remember driving down. I used to go to the different liquor stores and I lived at street at Alms House in 611, and there was a liquor store right there, but I would go to the different ones to get my wine. And I remember one day I'm driving down the road, driving down the hill, and all of a sudden it felt like time stood still. I went to Living Grin and I was telling my counselor this one time, and because we were talking about spiritual awakenings and all, you know, and God, and I didn't know if I believed in God. I was kind of agnostic when I came in. And so I told her, I said, you know, I was driving down this hill and all of a sudden it's just like time just stood still. I remember the point where I was and I thought, I can't do this anymore. Like, I can't do this anymore. I had this fear that somebody was going to die, and, you know, I'm in such good shape. No, I knew I wasn't in good shape, but I was still that second to the oldest, and I always had to control everything and everyone and take care of all. And I'm like, I can't take care of anybody right now. I know if something happens to my mom or my dad or somebody or whatever, something bad's going to happen. I just felt doom. I felt death, and I knew it, and I knew something was going to happen, and I knew I had to get sober. I knew I had to stop what I was doing. And I remember looking back on that, and that was a moment where I just felt like, yeah. She said to me when I was living room, she said, well, did it ever dawn on you that you were the one that was going to die? And I was like, oh, you know, now that you say that, I think I was the one, you know, I was the one that was going to die. But my daughter, it was now her 30th birthday, and I rented out. She's 9 months pregnant. And, you know, because I had very good judgment, I rented out the twin ice skating rinks so she could ice skate with all her friends. And and there she is, you know, 9 months pregnant. But I was in charge of, you know, I had to bring the, you know, the fountain, and I brought the fountain. And I made kamikazes in it, and I'm on the ice, and I'm mooning, and I'm, you know, just not, like, really acting very nice. And I couldn't keep my car there, and I used to think I was real responsible if I left my car other places, you know. That meant I was responsible. Because I had enough whereabouts to know I couldn't drive, because I couldn't walk or talk, usually, at that point. But, you know, I went home, and I left my car there, and I got a ride, and I kind of hid out. And my aunt, who's in the program, was there that night. And every now and then, when she would come over at one of the family parties, because she's in the program, I would hide my wine all over the house so she couldn't see me drink it, you know? But I always remember, like, because I get that energy, and I'd want to, like, table dance or something, and I'd always want to kick stuff. I don't know why. I wanted to kick everything. I wanted to wrestle, and I wanted to do splits. And I'm like standing there like, I can kick that. You want to see me? She's like, no, no. Here's a green card. Here's a green card. And I'm like, all right, I shouldn't have told her I wanted to kick that. So about 6 months before this, she had, I don't know why I was drunk in the middle of the night. I must have made a drunk phone call to her. She called me the next day. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm about to go to one of these meetings. So I went to Glenside. And there's people that told me a couple times I went there, and I don't remember at all. But I remember this one girl talking about when I went in there that she went to the grocery store. She had a relapse, and she was drinking whatever it was, cough syrup or something, or Listerine. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not an alcoholic. I would just go right to the liquor store, you know, forget about that. But it took me like 6 more months to come back in, and she sent me, after my daughter's birthday, she said, hey, Lisa, I went to this, I was hiding out for a few days, and she said, I went to this anniversary party over in Doylestown, and I heard this woman speak, and I was wondering, you know, would you give her a call? And I thought, I didn't have the fight in me anymore, you know, I just didn't have the fight. And I'm like, all right, I'll call her. She's like, you know, you need help, and I've been praying for you. So I kind of knew that I couldn't do it anymore, you know. I didn't know how. I picked up the phone, I called, and they answered the phone. It was the woman who spoke. She's like, live and grin. Oh, my gosh. So I wound up going to live and grin a few days later. I drank from that moment till the day I went in there. And when I went in there, I didn't know if I could stay sober. I didn't know if I wanted to stay sober. I didn't know, you know, like I remember going in and thinking, all right, I'll just do this for right, you know, just today. And it was always that just one day, just do it for today, you know. Can you do it till tomorrow? Well, I never told him really how much I drank and how much all the other things I was doing. And, you know, I was always reading self-help books and trying to do that. Like, I never knew what my problem was. I never knew what was the matter with me. And when I went there for probably the first few weeks, I, you know, just told them how much I hated everybody. I hated this. I hated that. And they're like, well, how do you feel about this? Or how do you feel about that? And I'm like, I don't know. I just told you I hate everybody. And so what they said to me, listen, you need to start going to AA meetings 3 times a week, and you need to get a sponsor. And so slowly but surely what started to happen to me, I started to bring my body, and that mind started to follow. I started going to meetings over at Andrews Hall, and I was really afraid not to go to meetings. I didn't feel like I belonged in AA. I didn't feel like I belonged outside AA. I didn't know where I belonged, you know. I didn't know if I wanted to tell anybody I was doing this because I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know if I liked it. But, you know, I remember looking at the steps on the wall, and I'd always sit on the one side. And I thought, you know, and they started talking about God. And I thought, well, I don't really know if I had foxhole prayers because I didn't think that God was going to help me, or I didn't think I was that bad or I needed help. Like, look at all the starving people in the world. Look at all these people, 9/11. Like, these people need your help. If you can't help them, why would you want to help me, you know? But I was told you have to start praying, you know. You have to find a woman to start to help you. And my mind was so insane. It was so crazy. You know, I just feel so sorry for people when they first come in because I had no clear, concise thought about anything. You know, I remember them telling me that, you know, it sounds like you have squirrels running around in your head. And I'm like, I think they're bats. They're bats. They fly in all different directions, and they bang off the walls, and it doesn't stop. And, you know, I listened to them. Like, sometimes I think I didn't listen. I tried to listen, you know, to the best of my ability. And I got a sponsor, and, you know, I hooked up with some people that were asking me to cop and asking me to do different things. Come on, we can sign the bars. That's what you're supposed to. Like, I did not hook up with really great people, to tell you the truth, and I made my life really miserable. I still wanted to go to the bars, and I still wanted to hang out with my friends, but I didn't drink. And that's but by the grace of God. You know, I was taught what it was like to be powerless over alcohol and over the people around me. I walked away from my marriage, my home, my security. You know, I walked away from a lot of things in order to keep this gift of sobriety. I didn't know if I wanted it, but I can't imagine my life without it right now. All the things and all the stuff that you have, the, you know, whatever, it just doesn't mean anything if you're in the ground. And when I completely lost myself and I started going to, you know, to Living Grand, I did 6 months of IOP, and I got a sponsor early on, and I just wanted people to invite me to parties, you know. I just wanted to be invited to things. I just wanted to be included in things. It's all I wanted. And I loved coming up here to this meeting outside because it felt like a big party, you know, the motorcycles pulling up, and it was like exciting and all. But, you know, without doing the work that's required in the program, there's no way to stay sober. You know, I couldn't be sober and get sober and have a spiritual awakening by standing on the outside of the rooms. You know, I've stood on the shoulders of many giants before me, and I am so grateful for that. But my sponsor in the beginning, every time I went to him, said, I hate this person, I hate that person, bull. She's like, put it on your list. Put it on your list. You know, and then I went with my journal of hate to do my fourth and fifth step. And, you know, and I had to, like, look at my part. She's like, do you see you? And I'm like, yeah, no, don't you see? I just told you everything I hate about him. She's like, you don't follow direction. I'm not going to sponsor you anymore. And I'm like, really? Okay. So then I went to this other woman. How come she's not sponsoring? I'm like, can you sponsor me? Well, why isn't she? Well, you don't follow direction. And I'm like, she said, I don't follow directions. She's like, well, you don't, so I'm not sponsoring. I'm like, oh, food. Then I went to another one, and she's like, if you smoke anywhere on the hospital ground, I'm not going to sponsor you. I'm like, don't you know that I have, like, you know, this problem with people that are going to leave me and stuff? So, you know, this isn't going to work out because I'm not going to, you know, I'm afraid of abandonment. And if I get threatened every time I do something wrong, you're going to abandon me. So, you know, I'm going to leave you before you leave me, you know, and then I'm going to sit outside and smoke and say, I told you so. And, you know, so it wasn't easy, you know, and people would be like, oh my God, you're so angry. What's your problem? You're so pissed off. I remember Jack in the back one day, I had like 2 years sober now, and I didn't have a sponsor because nobody would sponsor me or I'd fire them. And I was sitting up in Wrightstown because now I was met a lot of people at the meetings in Doylestown, so I went to a different meeting. And this guy was speaking, and Jack came back to me, and he said, look, I heard that you were up there last night. You were in a lot of pain, and I want you to call this woman. You know, you need to pick the phone up, and you need to give her a call. And so I did. He said, I'm going to call you every day till you call her. And I did that. I picked the phone up and I called her. Her name is Sammy G, and she's down in Powhatan, Virginia. She spoke up here before. But, you know, she told me every Friday we're going to sit down, you're going to open up the book, and we're going to go through the book. And so she opened the first page. She said, what's on the first page? We do it over the phone. I'm like, nothing. She said, that's because you don't know anything. You know, let's turn to the next page. And then, you know, she went through, you know, the three-legged stool, you know, the unity, the service, the recovery here, that we, you know, it's all of it. You can't stay sober on just one thing, you know, or another. She made me understand that, and I understood that if I was powerless and I had no power, that I had to find someone or something that had power. And I chose, you know, it was God. But I didn't believe in him right away. And it took a long time, you know. It took me a while because I needed to just keep on doing it over and over again. before I saw that my life started getting better. And before I didn't know if I could do it, do I want to do it? I'm like, I'm doing this. This is getting a little bit better, you know, so I think I can do this and I think I want to do this. And then, you know, my 30 days and 60 days and 90 days, you know, I had 18 days sober. My aunt, you know, oh, it's so great. You're an AA. Come on, we're going to go to the Roundup. Let's go to the Roundup. And I go to the Roundup. She was like, you know, greet her past. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, this is going to work. I don't want everybody to see that, like, I'm an alcoholic here, you know. And then I hid out my room, and then they were like, oh, look, there's this big dance, and everybody's dancing, and the music's going, and I'm in my room. It's like, come on, go down. And I'm like, oh, yeah, fake fun, fake party, fake dance, not doing it, you know. And that's how I was in the beginning. I'm like, I'm not doing any of that. It's not fun. But let me tell you something. From her bringing me to these meetings early on, going to the Roundup, I've gone to the Roundup in Canada. You know, when I had 1 year, I have been, I've skied down mountains in Colorado into meetings. I've been the 50th anniversary in Hawaii on surfboards and done meetings in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You know, I've gone to meetings all over this country, and thank God, like last week, I was in, like, you know, New York. And they're like, oh, Philly chicks are so scary. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought New York girls were so scary. And, you know, the woman stands here before you is not the woman that walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That woman needed to drink. You know, I don't need to drink today. Because of the steps, because of turning my will over to the care of God, because I was able to finally do an official, you know, fourth step inventory and make amends to some people. And really, all basically that let me know was all the things I was afraid of. You know, I did my sex inventory, I did my fears, and I was really afraid of everything. I had panic attacks constantly. You know, I was, I used to shake all the time, and I didn't know that was detoxing. And I was like, look at my nerves, look at my nerves, look at my nerves. I'm like, yeah, no. You know, like, I don't shake anymore. My legs don't twitch, and, you know, I talk a lot still sometimes. But, you know, I have always gone to meetings. I went to more meetings than you could imagine. I was told to get involved in service right away, and I did that. And it hasn't always been easy for me. It's the best thing I've ever done, you know, in my entire life. I couldn't imagine where I would be right now without it. You know, my daughter has 4 kids, and, you know, first one I went into the hospital room drunk. Second, well, I wasn't allowed to be there. Third, I wasn't. You know, fourth, she invited me in. We're best friends right now. Those kids, half of them don't know me drunk anymore, and I'm really happy for that. I still make a pretty regular attendance of meetings. And, you know, one of the things when I was in New York, the one guy was talking about Bill W., and, you know, they had asked him, why do you think so many people, you've been around so long, don't stay? You know, what do you think it is? Why do you think some stay, some don't? And he said, you know, I think they just fail to enlarge on their, you know, their spirituality, on their spiritual life. And at this point, you know, that's what it's about for me. It's carrying the message to another person, to letting people know, like, it wasn't easy coming in here. It wasn't easy not listening. I had my family and friends, nobody got it. Those neighbors never hung out with me anymore, you know, that I lived with for 11 years. My girlfriends, a few were in the program. My friends now are sober. I don't really care to have this enormous amount of posse with me, you know. I don't have to do that, but I do carry the message of recovery. I have a sister that's suffering terribly. I've, like, out of jail, got one that graduated Wharton, and, you know, cops are looking for her because she won't admit she has a problem with alcohol and has 4 kids, and you know, it's really bad. It's really gotten to a point, but I was where she is, you know. And then I have another sister that lives down in Kensington, and she had 8 years, or in Fishtown, and she had 8 years sober, and she went out, and I couldn't wait to have 9 years, just, you know, so I can just get past, like, that fear of going out. I don't have to ever, like, well, I was told when I came in this program, you are required to stay sober. Relapse is not a requirement. You got sober, and you're supposed to stay sober under any and all circumstances. And I've had a lot of conditions, my mom dying, a lot of people I know, You know, I mean, I've just had a lot of war stories since I've been sober. But under any and all circumstances, you do not pick up a drink. You pick up the phone, you call somebody, you help somebody, you keep coming to meetings. And my life is beyond my wildest dreams. Yeah, it's great. It's great. I can't imagine me feeling any better inside. We're at the end there, but you know, there was this thing in the grapevine I'm going to just share with you real quick, and it was this woman who wrote it, and because it's spring, and she said, "The things that used to keep me awake at night no longer bother me, because I can put them aside against the backdrop of eternity. The long, lonely, desperate winter that was alcoholism turned into spring, and the rebirth and the renewal of life. I have been reborn, you know, and I have found my God as a result of you people and through the steps. And if it weren't for all of you, I wouldn't be standing here right now." So that's all I got. Thank you.